Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, we're bringing you part two of our special program on the story of the Contras and cocaine. Last week, we heard from veteran investigative journalist Robert Perry, one of the first to report the involvement of the CIA-backed Contra Army in Nicaragua in drug smuggling. This week, we'll hear comments from Gary Webb, the reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, who uncovered new evidence connecting the Contras and the trafficking of crack cocaine in South Central Los Angeles just this past year. Bob Perry and Gary Webb spoke at a public forum held at the Midnight Special Bookstore in Los Angeles in early December. Now, when Perry and his partner Brian Barger, then at Associated Press, reported their story of the CIA's Contra Army involvement in drug smuggling in 1985, the country's leading media outlets heaped disdain on the story, going out of their way to discredit the reporters and to dismiss their findings. More than 10 years later, the reception from the elite media has not been much different to the new reports from the San Jose Mercury News. That part of the story, the mainstream press's role in undermining the investigators and doing image management for the CIA, is the topic of the cover story in the January-February issue of Fares Magazine Extra. The article is by Norman Solomon. We'll be getting a little preview of that story from Norman Solomon later on in the program, and I'll also be giving you information on how to get a hold of Extra, so you might want to get a pen and paper ready. But first, from the Midnight Special Bookstore in Los Angeles, here's San Jose Mercury News reporter Gary Webb.
I'm Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News. I've been a San Jose Mercury News reporter about 8 years. I worked for the Cleveland Plain Dealer 5 years before that, and I worked for the Kentucky Post 5 years before that. I've been in this business for a long time. I've done a lot of investigative reporting. I was one of, you know, several million Americans who may have seen little snippets of Bob's story back in 85 and thought, wow, this is really bizarre, and never heard of it again. And that was sort of the position I found myself in last year when I started working on the story that I ended up doing, which happened in a very roundabout way. I've been covering the drug war off and on for a while. I mean, some people ask me what I do for a living, and I say I'm a war correspondent. I cover the war on drugs. I had done a series a couple of years ago about asset forfeitures, which is this program where the police can come in and like take everything you own because somebody said you were a drug dealer. They didn't have to prove anything. They didn't have to find any drugs. They didn't have to make any arrests. It was like open season. And we did this story, we did the series, and like 3 weeks later, the California legislature changed the law, so now you at least have to be convicted of a drug crime before the police can take your property, which I think is, you know, somewhat more reasonable. But at any rate, after that story came out, I got a call from a woman in Oakland who I'd never heard of before. And she said she'd read my story and thought she had a pretty good follow-up to tell me about. And her story was this. Her boyfriend was a cocaine dealer, and he was this guy named Rafael Cornejo. And Rafael was a cocaine dealer, and that's pretty much all he did, and he made a lot of money being a cocaine dealer, and then he got caught. And while he was in jail, he was put in jail and held there on a no-bail warrant, and at the time she called me, he'd been in jail for 3 years and had never been brought to trial. And all of his property had been taken away, and he didn't, you know, he had to have a court-appointed lawyer, and he lost his house, lost his cars, yada, yada, yada. And she thought that might be a good story to follow up on as a follow-up to my asset forfeiture stuff. And I said, yeah, you're probably right. And then she mentioned the fact that one of the guys in his drug ring was a percussion player for Santana, which I thought, that's really interesting. So this might make it easier to sell this story. So So I went and I met with her, and her boyfriend had a court hearing coming up in San Francisco. And so I met her at the courthouse, and we sat down and talked. And she started giving me documents from her boyfriend's case that he'd gotten under discovery. And some of the documents she gave me pertained to this guy named Oscar Danilo Blandón, who was going to be a witness against her boyfriend. And when Rafael's lawyer found out that the guy was going to be a witness against him, he filed a motion for discovery, and the government turned over a lot of documents about Danilo Blandón. And one of the things they turned over was a grand jury transcript from 1994 in which he had gone before a San Francisco grand jury and talked about his career as a cocaine dealer. And in this grand jury transcript, which was heavily blacked out, I mean, they didn't turn it over uncensored. They went through with a magic marker and crossed out big parts of it. But he had talked about how he had been dealing cocaine in Los Angeles since the early 1980s, and how he got his start as a cocaine dealer was because the Contras needed some money. And he talked about, getting 2 kilos of cocaine in San Francisco and going to sort of a cocaine dealer school up there, in which he was taught how to weigh it and how to recognize good cocaine from bad cocaine and how to hide it in doors of pickup trucks. And I was looking at this document, and I got back to the office, and I called up my editor, and I said, do you remember something long, long time ago about the Contras and cocaine and something like that? And she said, yeah, but, just vaguely. And I said, yeah, that's the same way I am. I don't remember much about it, but I remember hearing something about it. I said, but I never remember seeing anything quite this black and white. And, I mean, this man's under oath, and he's under oath as a government witness, so why would he make stuff like this up? So she said, well, yeah, it sounds like a pretty good story. So I started, snooping around about it, and I called Bob. And I said, you're the guy that did this cocaine story. And he said, oh, and he told me this long tale of woe that happened when he had taken this story on. And I said, well, I think I'm going to go after this thing. Do you have any suggestions? And he said, well, the interesting thing is, he said, Lawrence Walsh's files, the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, his files had just been turned over to the National Archives. And he said they're going through and they're declassifying stuff. And he says, it's a long shot, but you might want to send a Freedom of Information Act request to the archivist and see if he's got anything on these guys. So I sent off a Freedom of Information Act request, fully expecting to hear nothing back. And I got a call from the archivist who said, hey, we found some stuff. We can release you about 36 pages. I said, great, send it to me. And so he sent me these FBI reports from 1986, which talked about this this fellow named Ronald Lister, who I had never heard of in my life, and Danilo Blandone. And what these reports said was that these guys were involved in drug trafficking, they were raising money for the Contras, and that at some point in time, because this part was blacked out, I couldn't really tell what they were talking about, Danilo Blandone's lawyer had called the L.A. County Sheriff's Department after his client had been raided and said, the CIA winked at this sort of thing. And then I called my editor up and I said, I think I got some confirmation for what this guy had told the grand jury. I mean, here's the 1986 FBI report that says he was dealing drugs for the Contras. 1994, he's saying the same thing for the grand jury. He's probably telling the truth. So at that point, we decided we needed to find Danilo Blandone. And Rafael's girlfriend, turns out, she knew a lot more than she let on at the beginning. She had grown up with this enclave of Nicaraguan cocaine dealers in San Francisco. And she knew a lot of them, and they were personal friends, and they were personal friends of Rafael's. And she sort of guided me through this underworld and let me talk to some people after assuring them that I wasn't a cop and I wasn't going to arrest them or anything. And they started telling me about a guy named Norwin Meneses, who it turns out in our story was the sort of the primo cocaine dealer for this Nicaraguan drug ring. He was a Somocista. His family, his brothers were generals in Somoza's army. One of his brothers was the ambassador to Guatemala. He was very well connected, and he was also a major cocaine trafficker in San Francisco. And from that point, we started putting together the story about these two Nicaraguan cocaine dealers and how they were working for the Contras. And I went down to San Diego and did some looking through some court records down there, and I came up with the case that got Danilo Blandone arrested and made him a government informant. And started calling the lawyers of the co-defendants because I wanted to try to find Blandone. I didn't know where he was. And I was going down the list, and nobody'd seen him. And I called one of the attorneys, and she said, oh, he's going to be in San Diego in a couple of weeks. And I said, oh, yeah, how's that? And she said, well, have you ever heard of a guy named Freeway Rick Ross? And I said, well, I had, because I had done this story on asset forfeitures, and one of the cases I looked at when I was doing this series was Rick Ross's case, because he never had anything forfeited to the government. The biggest crack dealer in L.A. got to keep all his property. So I knew who Rick Ross was. And I said, well, what does Rick Ross have to do with these Nicaraguans? And she said, well, they were his suppliers. And I said, wait a minute. The Contras were supplying Rick Ross with crack, with cocaine. She said, that's the information I have. So I called up Rick Ross, and he was in prison in San Diego, and I went down to talk to him, and I said, tell me what you know about this guy, Blandone. And he started telling me what he knew. And, you know, then I called my editor, and I said, I think we've got this story has gotten a little bigger than we thought, you know. And I said, I think I need to go down to Nicaragua because, Norma Meneses needs to be talked to, and we've got some people down there. And at that point, she said, now we're going to spend some serious money. We need to get approval from the managing editor. This is like six, eight months down the road. So we went in and laid out the story, and he got this big smile on his face, and he said, you know, go for it. Sounds great.
You're listening to Counterspin. We're hearing from San Jose Mercury News reporter Gary Webb. Webb spoke at the Midnight Special Bookstore in Los Angeles along with journalist Bob Perry. Webb has explained how he uncovered the information linking the Contras and crack cocaine in Los Angeles. Now he tells about how he reported it and the response that report received. Here's Gary Webb.
And so we spent the next 6 months working on this thing. And it culminated in this three-part series that we printed in August entitled Dark Alliance. And basically what the series says, well, let me start out by saying what the series doesn't say, because there seems to be a lot of confusion about that. It does not say that the CIA brainstormed a genocidal plot against black America. It doesn't say that at all. It doesn't say that the CIA masterminded the influx of crack into America. What it says is that this Nicaraguan Contra cocaine ring brought tons of cocaine into California, brought tons of cocaine into the South Central, and sold it to Freeway Rick, who turned it into crack and spread it first through Los Angeles and then through the rest of the country. It also talks about how they were meeting with the leaders of the Contra Army. One of the guys was on TV the other day, Adolfo Calero. We came up with a picture of Adolfo Calero in a kitchen in San Francisco standing next to Norwin Meneses, which incidentally, when I interviewed Meneses, he initially denied that he had anything to do with the Contras, and I pulled out this picture and showed it to him, and he goes, okay, you got me. Well, and he was pretty easy. He was pretty easy. We also discovered that, and Danilo Blandone testified to this when he took the stand against Rick Ross in March, that his first introduction to cocaine trafficking came when he went down to Honduras and met with a man named Colonel Enrique Bermudez, who was the military commander of the FDN, handpicked by the CIA, paid by the CIA to run that army. And Enrique Bermudez told him, you guys need to go to California and raise some money for the FDN, and the ends justify the means. He testified to that in court as a government witness under oath. So, that's as far as we got on the CIA angle of it. You know, that's all we said, was that these men met with CIA agents while they were dealing cocaine and just before they started dealing cocaine. We also talked about the impact that this Contra drug ring had on the crack crisis in America. And what was amazing to me to find out was that, you know, like a lot of Americans, I believe that the crack epidemic sort of sprung up overnight in 1986 and suddenly it was everywhere. That's what Congress believed when they passed these laws to put people away for years and years and years. Actually, crack had been around for quite a while. And it started in South Central Los Angeles. And as we pointed out in our story, these Nicaraguans created the first mass market for crack in the United States in South Central Los Angeles, because they hooked up with Freeway Rick. And Freeway Rick, you can say what you want about him, the guy was a genius. He knew how to sell drugs. And he did, you know, amazingly well at it, too well at it. But for years and years and years, Rick Ross had no idea who he was getting his dope from. He knew he was getting it for cheaper than anybody else in town could supply it for him, and believe me, When you're a drug dealer the size of Rick Ross, everybody wants to sell you dope. Everybody wants to sell you dope because you can move it. And Rick didn't need to go to other people to get dope because he was getting the cheapest price anybody could find from these Nicaraguan Contras. And when we went down to Nicaragua, we found out why he was getting it so cheap. Because in the cocaine business, and I had several cocaine dealers telling me this, the biggest cost of the drug is getting it up here. Transportation costs. That's what costs you the most. And their transportation costs were next to nothing. And the reason they were next to nothing, and we found this, and this was in a file in the Supreme Court in Nicaragua, sworn testimony from a government witness again. The drugs were being flown into the United States aboard Salvadoran Air Force planes. We found the man who was the connection to the Salvadoran Air Force, a guy named Marcos Aguado, who Bob has probably run across. He was a Nicaraguan Contra pilot, flew for our day, developed very close relations with the Salvadoran Air Force, and were flying drugs out of Ilopango Air Base. We found a DEA agent, again, hardly a radical, who was investigating drug trafficking at Ilopango Air Force Base in El Salvador, reported that there was drug trafficking going on the military side of this air base in Ilopango, wrote reports to Washington, listed the tail numbers, listed the pilots, listed their criminal records. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. The only thing that happened, he got a set of guy from Washington came down and said, you know, you really ought to use the word allegedly when you're talking about these drug flights out of this air base. And he said, well, I'm watching them go out of here with my own eyes. Why do I have to use the word allegedly? And he never really got an answer to that. Yeah, Sally Castillo. That's the guy. So at any rate, we did the story. Nobody said anything for a couple of weeks. We did another story after that. We finally got a copy of a search warrant affidavit that was filed in 1986 and disappeared. This was when the L.A. County Sheriff's Office raided this Nicaraguan drug ring in October. Ironically, the same day Reagan authorized the $100 million aid bill to the Contras, they raided Danilo Blandón's drug operation. According to the search warrant affidavit, the L.A. County Sheriff's had information that this drug ring was run by Danilo Blandón. It involved more than 100 Contra sympathizers. They were funneling money to a bank in Florida and buying arms to the Nicaraguan Contras. It was all in a sworn police affidavit in 1986 that nobody ever saw because it disappeared after it was filed. We did that story. We did another story about when they raided this guy Ronald Lister's house, who was one of the money launderers for this drug ring. He was standing there in his bathrobe, and he told the cops, you're not supposed to be here. And the cops said, why not? And he said, well, because I'm working with the CIA, and my friends in Washington are going to be very unhappy about this. This was in a police report that allegedly disappeared. I mean, when we asked for it, we were told it didn't exist. When Maxine Waters went down to the sheriff's office and refused to leave until they gave her the report, she got it. She got it. And there it was in black and white. There it was in black and white. Since then, there have been a lot of stories about our series that say, oh, you know, this isn't true. These guys really weren't Contras after all, you know. Yeah, there's that picture of Adolfo Calero, but you know, he's such a big celebrity, everybody wants his picture taken with him. Yeah, and then there was this thing in the LA Times, which, you know, our series was based, we didn't use any unnamed sources. I mean, we made a rule that we're not using unnamed sources. This is such an important story. It's going to be so scrutinized. We don't want to use unnamed sources. We want documents, we want sworn testimony, we want whatever we can get. LA Times goes out with a story quoting an unnamed source that says, well, we only think they gave him $50,000, and suddenly that's fact everywhere in the world. You know, if we'd have used unnamed sources, I hate to think what they'd have been saying about us. But be that as it may, there have been some congressional hearings started. I'm not so sure about the direction they're going, at least the ones that I've seen on TV. But again, you know, Aiden Pastora, one of the Contra leaders, got up there last week and testified that, yeah, Danilo Blandón gave me $6,000. Yeah, he gave me some pickup trucks. Yeah, I was living in his house. But, you know, the Contras weren't dealing drugs, and they weren't giving us any money, and then yada, yada, yada. So I think this story is really just starting now to come out. The series that we did was just the start of what we're intending to print. We've got a couple more in the works. They'll be in print before the end of the year. And I mean, this is a story that Bob can attest. I mean, this is a historical fact. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is not, you know, some people in a back room thinking about how they can smear Ronald Reagan after all these years. This is a fact. These are historical facts. And that's one of the beauties of doing the story 10 years later, is because you've got a paper trail a mile wide. Bob, unfortunately, was doing it while it was going on, which is a very much more difficult story to nail down, because you've got people in the midst of committing criminal acts that really don't want that exposed. So at any rate, I think there's more information coming. You know, people need to get a hold of their congressman and make sure that this one doesn't get shut down like the Kerry Committee investigation got shut down. And maybe it takes 10 years for the truth to come out, but it comes out eventually.
You're listening to Counterspin, and that was San Jose Mercury News reporter Gary Webb speaking at the Midnight Special Bookstore in Los Angeles. Gary Webb talked a bit about how mainstream journalists have misreported his Dark Alliance series, and it's that aspect of this story that's addressed in the cover story of the January-February issue of Fares Magazine Extra. We spoke with that story's author, Norman Solomon, by telephone, and the first thing we asked him was what he meant by calling the article Snow Job, and what were his major findings.
Well, the story is called Snow Job because that's really a good summary of what has come from the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times. We begin the report with a quote from George Orwell, who talks about the newspeak pattern of pulling certain facts into the open only to the extent that they can serve a very selective version of reality, and then putting those facts away when they no longer become convenient. All three of these major newspapers really kept banging on the same drum, drawing on the same themes, and using the same, usually unnamed official sources to try to trash what the Mercury News had done. For instance, all three of these papers relied on the CIA to exonerate the CIA, and you had many unnamed officials who were cited as kind of touchstones for veracity to establish that the accusations against the Contras who were linked to the CIA had no basis of fact when it came to cocaine trafficking. You also had the theme of black paranoia, that African Americans simply were prone to hysterical belief in unfounded rumors. And that was a way to try to get out from under the very clear evidence that Gary Webb had unearthed. So in L.A. and New York and D.C. at these three mega newspapers, you had a newsroom culture of denial. And the denial was that the CIA had close ties with the Contras, and also that the Contras had a long history of cocaine drug smuggling, so that all three of these newspapers kept claiming that the Contra drug connection was an old story, at the same time that they failed to acknowledge how those very same papers had either trashed the story, denied it, or ignored it at the time. So you had this kind of weird Orwellian process of saying that something had already been reported and that it wasn't very important, that it shouldn't be exaggerated. But if you go back into the microfilm and on Nexus computer databases and so forth, you find either inadequate reporting or no reporting at all, or actual attacks on reality. And one other facet I want to mention, in these newspapers, there was a constant pattern of using the opinion pages to echo what was in the news pages, even though the initial reporting in October to trash the Mercury News was fraught with very shoddy sourcing and lousy journalism. So, for instance, you had Mary McGrory or Richard Cohen in the Washington Post, Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, putting in their columns the assessment that this story was settled and the Mercury News had done bad journalism, whereas our report documents, I think, something quite the opposite.
Well, one major outlet, the Los Angeles Times, has even reversed itself on an important element of this story. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're really in Orwell land here, where the Los Angeles Times joined with those two other dailies in downplaying the importance of a crack dealer named Ricky Ross, who was supplied by a pair of Nicaraguan drug smugglers linked to the Contras. If you go back 2 years to December 20th, 1994, the LA Times described Ross as the, quote, king of crack, whose, quote, coast-to-coast conglomerate, unquote, was responsible for what the LA Times 2 years ago called a staggering turnover that put the drug within reach of anyone with a few dollars, unquote. 2 years later, when the facts had emerged that Ricky Ross was directly getting his cocaine that he turned into crack from Nicaraguan dealers who were supporting the Contras, all of that flipped 180 degrees in the other direction. The LA Times ran a front page story in October of 1996 saying that Ricky Ross was no big deal, that he was incidental to the spread of crack. And this theme, this kind of inversion of past reporting to serve the CIA line, was also heard very loudly in the national media echo chamber, coming from the Washington Post and the New York Times as well.
Finally, Norman, what's been the impact, and what do you think are the ramifications of this type of coverage?
I think these three newspapers have had an enormous effect in stopping the momentum of this national story. These are agenda-setting papers. They're linked into the national security state as well as the major mass media of the country. And it's our task now to deconstruct the pseudo-journalism that the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times have done on this story, and to really expose to the light the outrageous lack of journalistic quality that has undermined the basic claims that they've made. In other words, these papers have helped other national media to rationalize further burying the truth, and journalism is supposed to be doing something quite opposite than burying the truth.
That was syndicated columnist Norman Solomon, the author of the article Snow Job, that is the cover story of the new January-February issue of Extra. If you'd like subscription information for Extra, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. 1-800-847-3993. Tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you'd like a sneak preview of the Snow Job story, you can check out FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org/fair. Again, that's www.fair.org/fair for a preview of the Snow Job story, as well as other information about FAIR's work. We hope you enjoyed this special presentation of Counterspin. The show is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR in New York and engineered at Mercer Street Sound. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.